Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bolano, edited by her son, James W. Bolano. Our last episode kept our diarist and us at sea, literally and metaphorically. Calm winds and bad tempers, illness of the pregnant Dorothea and of Captain Fred. The author tries to include reading in her days at sea to keep her mind as it was in her college days. She wonders again about this marriage to a much less educated man, but she suspects their characters are very similar. She also took us along for lessons as she studied celestial navigation, then toured Washington, D.C., and Mount Vernon, the home of our country's first president. Let's continue. Saturday, July 15th, 1911. On board all day, and we finished discharging cargo. Cousin Roscoe writes that he has enough work for 10 men to do and cannot come over to visit. Too bad, because he and I are the only college graduates in the town of St. George, Maine. Fred says Roscoe went to college because he could never learn to sail a ship. I don't believe that. Fred says there's no reason for St. George boys to go to college unless they want to be preachers, lawyers, or doctors. He says every boy can make a better living going to sea, and that college would spoil good seamen, making nothing but a bunch of sea lawyers nautical for troublemakers. Is that thinking akin to the Puerto Rican philosophy of keeping the women barefoot and pregnant? I did want to go to church tomorrow for the music and the sermon's uplift and to see people, but my boy is so tired and busy I guess I'd better not try it. Also, we may sail this evening, and in this heat I'm more comfortable on board. Sunday, July 16th, 1911. Did not sail because there is doubt about whether we are chartered to go to Jacksonville. Ice cream made by yours truly in the evening as a special treat for Fred after a bad day working on his pump. Read a good story in the Post by a new writer, Melville Davidson, Post. Purchased The Inner Shrine, highly recommended. I hope it is good reading. I need such if we're bound in this heat for torrid Jacksonville. Monday, July 17th, 1911. Towed down to Canton Hollow to load gravel ballast. Holds are in a mess, and engine needs repairs for pumping and later hoisting sails. Fred on shore all morning. Our new engineer, the third in less than 2 weeks, thinks he owns more of this ship than does Fred. I hope he won't be too bossy when Fred returns, because Fred will throw him ashore in no time. The way the engineer tries to boss the mate around is a caution. He will learn. Oh, he will learn when Fred gets back. Fred remembers his grandfather telling him of the donkeys that were carried on the olden day ships to run continuously around the capstan shaft below deck, hence the term donkey engine, when vessels finally displaced the poor animals, some of which were blinded with steam. He still calls an engineer donkey man when he wants to put him in his place. Have been writing letters and told my mother of the wisdom of sailors, how today there came on board a package of chiclets, chewing gum for me, and the mate put them in the engine room for repairing leaks in the pump. Oh me, oh my, and Fred says they don't need education. Tuesday, July 18th, 1911. Began reading The Inner Shrine today. Took a snap of the bay this morning. A card from Linda, thanking us. Must write her. Thanks, B. The pump is finally sucking water, and has caught the rising water in the hold at last. But just as it did, oh irony or fate, the steam pressure from the donkey engine went down. We were flooded until Fred and the engineer got steam up, and now we're out of trouble. The old steward goes on and on about how such wouldn't have happened on Captain J.W.'s Margaret Thomas. For him, there's no ship like her, and no skipper like Captain J.W. He has even been heard by me to say, "That dumb Fred," an allusion to the years Fred served as mate to his father, when the old steward would hear their Starbuck-like interchanges. Fred likes to have the old steward with us, because he's a wonderful cook, and says he'll be all right when we get to sea and away from the Pabst beer, which must be loaded with Dutch courage. The steward is an old devil, but looks like Puck, with his beery smile covering that cherubic face under the tipsy derby, and he loves to sweetly belittle Fred by reminding him in front of me how little Fred used to ride his red tricycle about the decks of the Margaret Thomas. He fairly swooned with pleasure yesterday when I told Fred, who was bothering me, to go ride his tricycle. Fred could not utter a word in reply, and I thought he was shocked, surprised, chagrined, and grieved. But finally out came that slow, lovely smile for which I married him as well, of course, as for his nose and a chance to roam the world. J.P. Morgan's yacht, the Corsair, passed down the bay yesterday, and methinks he has nothing on little me. I can live like a millionaire on this beautiful four-masted yacht of mine without being one. I cannot understand why Mother B. says she's served her time at sea and goes no more with Captain J.W. But then, anyone who refuses to eat those luscious strawberries in Rio de Janeiro because they're out of season back home in Maine doesn't have a chance to enjoy the big world. Wednesday, July 19th, 1911. Still lying at anchor, and I am full of ennui. We've pumped the whole of Chesapeake Bay through this ship, but I always feel blue on the dark of the moon. Went ashore yesterday with the feeling of, oh boy, oh joy, but almost fainted when the physician said I was not pregnant, but had eaten too many soft-shelled crabs. Bought a black leather handbag to console me, and how I do enjoy swinging it like any sailor's dolly. Was to meet Fred at the Crown for lunch, but the handbag delayed me, and I was late. He worried a heap, bless him. Hired a launch and went aboard just as he was arriving. Had words with him, and now I dread the Jacksonville trip as well as the terrible heat down there. Wish we could get to the other side of the Gulf Stream, such as Europe, where our American stream moderates the European climate. On this side of the stream it's either too hot or too cold. Fair France does not go to such extremes. Spent the afternoon adding to my compilation of seagoing lingo. A holiday is a spot left unpainted. Sou'westers, the heavy weather hats, get the name from England, where dirty weather comes from the southwest, from the Gulf Stream. Channel fever comes from England, too, where all hands change their outlook when coming home and approaching the English Channel. Scowegian, the name for a Scandinavian, is a comical mixture of scow with Norwegian. Schooner rigged means a sparsity of belongings and derives from the full-rigged sailor's disdain for the lightness of the number of sails on a schooner. Uncle Sam's crow is the United States eagle on the stamp of customs documents. Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves are the customs officials who have been known to confiscate precious but hidden bottles. It's a language unto itself. The animal kingdom enters strongly into the speech of men who seldom see animals. A heaving line is thrown with a monkey's fist, a decorated knot is a cat's paw, a back splice is, heavens be, a dog's cock. A knot to hold a line on a gangway is a Turk's head. Ratlines are part of the standing rigging. Holding the anchor from paying out is a claw. An incompetent seaman, quote, ain't worth a fart in a gale of wind, unquote. A deaf one, quote, can't hear himself fart, end quote. Poor dear mamma, pray for your wayward daughter. To heave a line is just a bit. In just a bit is, quote, a cunt's hair, end quote. What good books have you read late, Dorothea? Thursday, July 20th, 1911. On shore today, where we lunched with Captain Smith of Bath on, of all things, soft-shelled crab. Heard several captains say how able and smart, meaning competent, was my boy who looked some old elegant, that's down east for good, in his new blue suit. I had made him get it. He cares nothing for dress. The old steward often tells and tells again how disgusted Captain J.W. used to be with Fred, who would, when forced to put on a necktie, adorn his neck with a rope yarn. But, oh, he's a darling boy. He had the ship chandler throw into the stores for the trip some grape juice and some malted milk for me, so I could stand the Florida heat. Won't it taste good at sea? Won't it just? Must write Brother Roy out in dismal Minnesota and poor Betty Holbrook before we sail. Must be careful to use their English instead of my sea-going lingo. Altogether incomprehensible to them, and overly graphic. Friday, July 21st, 1911. I have sea fever, want to get sailing and use my newly acquired ability, on paper at least, to take longitude sights. But on shore, we did go again early in the morning and over to Druid Hill Park, where the thick grass felt good under my bare feet. Lunched at the Crown with Mr. Washburn of Thomaston, part owner of the Hopkins, the Fred B. Bellano three-master, the Carrie T. Bellano, the John Bellano, and the J.W. Bellano, all valuable vessels that do well for him and our family. Fred could stay ashore and help run the fleet, but he'd rather go to sea, and so would I. It's better than living back in Squeedunk. Saw the big collier Neptune go down the bay this morning. Carries 13,000 tons of coal. I suppose we'll have to get into steamships, but both of us dread it. Such smoke and living high above the water instead of down below in our cozy cabin. We both detest rust buckets, but apparently they're here to stay, damn them. Our comfy cabin is cool, and one hears the sea go by. Saturday, July 22nd, 1911. L'envoi, happy days, towing down the bay with the Curtis Bay tug groaning ahead of us. Letter from Mama telling me she worries and hoping I can visit her during Chautauqua season when, quote, many wonderful preachers will come from as far away as Boston, end quote. Thanks, Mama, but I think I'll just sail. Beautiful nor'west wind. Wish we were clear of the capes and bowling along at sea. Chautauqua. Bah! Sunday, July 23rd, 1911. No wind and anchored all morning off Cape Henry. I asked Fred if he didn't have another pair of old shoes for throwing overboard to make a sacrifice for wind to the gods, says Fred. I don't know nothing about sacrifices to the gods. I threw them shoes overboard because I've seen the old-timers do it. Besides, they said not to do it too often, or it wouldn't work. I'll save my old clothes for when we really need a breeze. And sure enough, about noon a fair wind sprang up, and we sailed merrily out to sea, steering by the wind, that is, with the wind just aft of the beam. Read The Brass Bowl, a right interesting burglar yarn by Lewis Vance, who knows just what I want in a sensational story. Made Currituck light by dark and passed Bodie Island in the night. I took four-point bearings and plotted our distance off in order to get a good departure for my morning longitude sights. I'll try to cross the Pole Star for latitude with Arcturus and Capella for longitude, and that should give a good fix. The stars are hardly visible by naked eye just before sunrise, but they're here for anyone to see who has the good fortune to see verse through a sextant. The old steward made delicious doughnuts, and I sewed. I want a sewing machine, and will see to it that I get one. Tuesday, July 25th. Wind died yesterday, and we were still on sounding, so we anchored at 4 p.m. Saw Cape Hatteras at dark. At anchor all night, and how this ship did roll in the seaway. I ought to write some letters, but it's more fun fishing, as we did last night, with lights over the stern to attract the schools of mackerel. Hoisted sails at 6 a.m., and are headed south, with just enough breeze to give us steerage way. At 9 we sighted Hatteras lightship and steered close by, within a heaving line's distance, so as to ask them to report us, as they have wireless. Fred told about the neophyte captain of a tugboat who had come down to salt water from the Great Lakes and was on his first trip out of Boston to solicit tows of sailing ships up into the harbor. Never having seen a lightship, he went alongside of the Boston lightship and sang out, "You want a tow? Only $50. The lightship skipper yelled, "You damn fool, this is a lightship," said the innocent. "Don't make no difference. Light or loaded, it's $50. Of course, I don't believe that for one instant. It's just saltwater disdain for freshwater men. It's like Fred saying there are two kinds of Maine people. The coastal ones are called sea maniacs, he says, and the interior tribe are swamp maniacs. Thursday, July 27th. Washed today, damn it. Use the little ship's boiler for the first time. Of washing, Fred said his mother used to berate the old steward, who would proudly come aft with Fred's clean diapers and, proud at saving water on a long trip, boast that the intimate baby garments had been washed and rinsed und den boiled all in von Wasser. La plus ça change. Past Cape Lookout lightship at noon today. 12 schooners in company with us, all bound south and, I dare say, all praying after their own fashion for a good wind to get around frying pan shoals. Fred says the bottom hereabouts is so thick with hurricane-murdered ships that one could walk under water on them without touching bottom. My clothes look lovely, and as they hang on the line over the cabin in the sun to dry, seem to attract more attention from the crew than they might receive from landsmen, who see such things more frequently than seamen. To the crew, they have all the oddness of a zoo. Finished all the sewing on my linen corset cover, and shall proudly change the M on it for a fancy embroidered B, Sila. Heard a new one today. The second mate disputed with Fred about the course laid out for clearing frying pan shoals. Seems Fred had given the mate one course, and he gave another to the man at the wheel. Fred took the mate into the chart room to prove his point, gently and without the usual brawling. That was too much for the second mate, who is not accustomed to kind words. The worthy then said, "Either course will get us there." Fred had exhausted his rare attempt to persuade instead of order. "Don't give me none of your goddamn backslack," I heard him say as they emerged. After a bit of thought, I figured it out. When heaving or pulling on a rope with a winch or capstan, the slack must be taken up, or there will be rope underfoot, snarls, and dangerous backlash, possibly. So, to a sailor, an uncalled-for reply is backslack. I asked Fred to substantiate my theory, and he just looked at me. "Why do you bother your pretty head with that stuff?" he said. "I don't know where it come from. All I know is backslack's no good." My intellectual lover boy. Friday, July 28th, 1911. 207 miles to Jacksonville, according to my sights at dawn. 200 according to Fred's. Finished ironing after breakfast, and my back is broken. 11 other schooners in sight. Wonder what happened to the 12th? When I took my sights, I proudly told Fred I had shot Capella, using his seagoing expression. "Poor bastard Capella," said Fred. "I hope you just wounded him." Mercy, what a childish sense of humor. Saturday, July 29th, 1911. I knew from the remark about Capella that foul weather was brewing in the head of my sometimes ugly love. Sure enough, today he started talking about Betty again. Have I displeased him? I do wish he would stop it, even though he may just be letting off steam at being bound to just one woman after his career of the 41+. I hope that notorious skirt chaser, Captain Kent, has not influenced my boy toward going to other women. Then I suppose he wouldn't be a good sailor if he didn't. Do I pray or swear? Swearing will be more effective with him. I'll swear. At least I no longer will have to search for the proper profanity to use. I've memorized it all, with right emphasis. Did Fred's ties and made some fudge. Wrote friends in Ponce. Caught a lovely mackerel so enormous Fred had to help me land it over the rail. Fresh fish for supper, and wouldn't you know it, the steward made dumplings to go with the fish. Noodle. I'm slowly picking up some German for when we sail to Europe, God willing. Sunday, July 30th, 1911. Fred says he'll take me to Bremen, Maine, where German is still spoken by the German settlers sent over by the Hanoverian kings. He says around Waldeboro, the Gentners, Brauns, Simmons, and Manns have kept up some German among the old folk. I told him how nice that was, but I was thinking more of Bremen, Germany. He told me to speak to Mr. Thurlow and Mr. Washburn, the managers of the charters. Believe you me, I shall do just that. Another mackerel caught last night, and wasn't it some delicious for breakfast this morning? I said that the steward had told me it was a Spanish mackerel. Fred said he didn't hear the mackerel talk. For that I should have slapped the mackerel in his face, the dear, darling, strong sea captain, with the humor of a sixth grader. Read the August Cosmopolitan today, and certainly enjoyed the yarn by C.N. Buck about the playwright, the Queen Bee, Dimity, and Butler. After a calm morning, there is a good breeze this evening, thanks be. Only about 180 miles to go. Roast chicken for dinner, and how good it does taste at sea. Our coop still contains 4 Chanticleers, which try their best to wake me before dawn for star sights, bless them. Fred says he and I will get all the eggs those roosters lay this trip, none for the crew. My boy, my boy. Monday, July 31st, 1911. Washed clothes again, and again, and all through by 10:30. Used carbon paper to help embroider my corset cover. Linen all made up, praise the Lord. Consumed an entire bottle of grape juice in the heat. It'll be much hotter on land. How I dread the land when it's unpleasant. No channel fever for me this trip, so long as the grape juice lasts. Wednesday, August 2nd, 1911. Just love the way Fred wakes me up in the morning. Dodie, little Dodie, wake up. And then a kiss. Dodie, it's time for you to take the sights and tell me where we are. More loving. Then the stars, the figuring, the comparison of his sights with mine, compromises on just exactly where we are. Then a tale, the latest about how when Fred was second mate, he'd use the point of a pencil to show his father precisely within a heaving line's distance of their position. When he was mate, he matured a bit and wasn't quite so sure of the pencil point position, so he'd put his thumb on the chart and say they were about there, within a 20-mile radius. Quote, When I got my own ship, I used the palm of my hand, covering 50 miles, and I'd say, "That's where we are." End quote. Hey-ho, why can't I have breakfast after sights instead of waiting until 7 o'clock? Why am I always hungry at sea? Only 80 miles to go, and that's not bad with all the headwinds we had. 30. Thursday, August 3rd, 1911. Passed two lights last night, Brunswick, Georgia, and Fernandina, Florida. Only about 15 miles to go, but the wind was contrary during the night, and we had to run out to the east. A towboat is in sight, probably out from Fernandina, and she may be here to pick up the Bertram, Captain Pinkham, sailing astern of us and bound for Fernandina for railroad ties. My new linen drawers are turning out beautifully now, all stitched by hand, damn it. They're saucy. Wonder how soon we shall arrive off Jacksonville. Despite the damnable heat of the godforsaken place, I hope it will be soon so I can get it over with the quicker. Pilot at 10 minutes after midnight and the tugboat Three Friends. Fred said he didn't need her yet, not at $50, but to come back when we got farther in and we'd pay 30. They settled at $40. Down east trickery. We towed up the St. John's River and went ashore. Jacksonville is a new, quite modern city, with wide streets, a white marble post office, and quite different from the other southern towns which are older and show it. 'Tis said of some of these southerners that they do not know the Civil War has ended. This city does. It owes its growth and prosperity to Yankee markets and ingenuity. All of the 75,000 inhabitants seem to have more get-up-and-get than most southerners, but it's still hellishly hot. Had supper on shore at the Metropolitan. Fried young chicken and cantaloupe. Were they good. And beginning to think more highly of Jacksonville. That's all the time we have for this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, The Diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.